dun 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 bum 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 dun 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 and then it's like the fussy fellas Verdon viewers viewers bum 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 ba.
Hello and welcome to Fussy Fellas Verdon Viewers, the podcast about the FX musical drama series Fussy Verdon that's on FX, so a subsidiary of Fox, which is a subsidiary of Disney. My name is Jimmy Blackman.
My name is Marty Scanlon. I'm a subsidiary of my parents.
they had a merger in, I don't know, 1989, 88?
Ooh,
I don't know.
So close, 88, yes.
88, successful merger. The company has grown by leaps and bounds every year and has continued on into the 21st century and is facing the problems of automation head on.
You just painted a grim portrait of what my life has basically become.
I mean, I was just trying. I didn't think that was a grim report. I was trying to do like the stockholders share, you know, the quarterly reports. You know, things are all good at MCS. That's your ticker number.
Wow,
right? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's right. No, that's good.
Wait, is that your initials? Did I?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're MC Scanlon. Okay, that's how I knew that. I was like, wait, did I just... Okay. All good. Good start to the podcast, doing a little bit about shareholders meetings.
And then welcome to another episode of Bit Explainer. This is a podcast within a podcast where we break down some of our best and most classic bits.
Yeah.
Now, in that moment, we were treating me as though I was a corporation.
That's right. Absolutely, we were... guys, invest in cryptos. I don't know. I don't know. I think you guys should put all your money in cryptos, everybody. My name is Jimmy Blackman,
and I'm Marty Scanlon. Yeah, we are.
We do a podcast.
We do a podcast called Smash Bros, where we watch Smash and become bros. But we're not doing that, James.
No, Martin. What we're doing right now is a podcast called Fussy Fellas Verdon Viewers, where we watch Fussy Verdon and become better viewers.
And fellas.
And better fellas. And we're here this week to talk about episode 6. We're rounding into the fourth quarter of Fussy Verdon. This episode is called, this is a classic segment on the show where I ask Marty what the title of the episode was. Marty, hit me with that title.
That title, here, hold on. That was me trying to type really fast. The episode is called All I Care About Is Love.
Which is a song from the musical Chicago, I believe, sung by the character Billy Flynn. In this case, it's the title of an episode of Fussy Verdon, and we're going to talk a little bit about that episode.
Yeah, this was the thing that stuck out to me the most in this episode was the editing. The editing was I like love editing video. I have always really enjoyed it since I was like a young lad with my first computer. That was like,
are you like Topher Grace, where you take movies and like re-edit them and stuff?
Exactly. I turned The Matrix into a nine minute comedy for Adult Swim.
Yeah. talk about the editing, because I also agree, but I don't have the expertise in editing that you do.
I don't have much expertise beyond just like good editing. Right, like you don't notice good editing unless it's for a specific purpose for storytelling, but I just think that, I mean, it's a testament to the direction and the writing and the editing, but particularly the editing, that watching these cuts happen between Bob Fosse's sort of wild internal life while he's working on the show and the show informing, though the fact that he is in an editing room and this episode is edited so seamlessly but choppy, but back and forth between his internal life and his external life and his past and his internal monologue, I thought it was just like really, really effective, really satisfying use of the medium.
And in a way that's stream of consciousness would be the wrong way to describe it, because the episode does have a clear linear plot to it, but in a way that is like, there's no there's no obvious rhyme or reason to like how you should be cutting between sort of these three things, which is the present day storyline, the stylized stand up comedy,
which I love, living in his film, which I also
that's like one of my favorite devices they've used so far. Yes, me too. Then the flashbacks to his childhood. It doesn't follow unless there may be a structure they've just covered it up very well of like how those three things they inform each other like three great like jazz improvisers or something who are just like all masters of their craft and are all on stage and just pass the ball back and forth and just know how to pass it back and forth in a way where in a lot of less confidently edited shows it would be like, you know, at this key moment we cut to this moment of him like saying this that, but it's just so much cutting where there's no, it just feels like this like rhythmic roller coaster that you're on through basically the whole episode.
I really enjoyed this one a lot. I think
this is maybe my favorite episode so far of the show.
This is one of my favorites for sure. If I think back on like what my actual favorites are, I'm like, oh shit, it's all sort of blending together in a good way that it's just telling this sort of seamless story. But this was definitely one of my favorites. I found that it ended and I just sat there for a little while in a way that I haven't done with a TV show in some time, of just like, I'm just gonna kind of absorb this one in for a minute.
I would like to say the same thing, but it ended and I immediately texted you, okay, I'm ready to record, because I'm very, this episode is very fresh in my memory. But
great.
I know,
well,
exactly,
I watched it a couple days ago, so
yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that. I mean, it like this show, this word has connotations that are negative, and I don't mean in a negative way at all. This show is exhausting. Like, it is, like, it is a draining show to watch, I think. Because it's, like, it's a very dark show. I mean, it's, like,
it's very heavy.
It's very heavy. That's probably the better way to put it, because it's not exactly a dark show, but it's a very, very heavy show, and very, like, it confronts its issues head on. Like it's a show about death and about like you're just like an inability to connect, and about how you can have everything in the world and still be at your core like an empty person, and that's just like what the show is about. And this episode was very much about that, and I just love how it's able to like deal with those sort of issues while also being a really fun and exciting, snazzy show to watch.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I just was very pleased watching this episode. I just sort of enjoyed it, and I often have to be in the right mood to watch this show, and I sometimes have to be like, okay, here we go, I'm gonna like hunker down and watch it. It's not like where I can just, you know, turn on The Office for the 20th time and just have it on. I have to like really focus. And so
to feel like
the reward is worth it's not risk reward, because it's not a risk to watch a show that has challenging subject matter, but it is sort of like I'm making a conscious decision to sit down and use my time right now to watch this, and to feel rewarded for doing that is so satisfying in an age when there's so many shows that are just like not that way.
Well, because I think a lot of shows that are like important, heavy shows are rewarding to watch, but they feel like a chore. I mean, that again, that's not necessarily a chore, but it's like this show is a joy to watch, but also makes you feel complicated, like, feelings.
Yes.
And that's, you know, I was talking with somebody yesterday about the show Barry. Do you watch Barry on HBO?
I actually just watched all of season one 2 days ago.
So that's a show to me that is, like, so impressive in the way that it balances tones and, like, is able to be both this like very funny satire of struggling actors and that world of that sort of just like gross Hollywood world, and then also be this like very tense, you know, hitman
gripping
drama
sort of thriller. Gripping,
like, and I just think that's so impressive, because a lot of really good shows are really good at doing staying in their lane, and I love a show that's not afraid to just like be like, we don't really have a lane. We have
Yeah, we have a story that we're telling. Yeah. We have a... Yeah, also, I think Barry, as a complete, just, like, offshoot, does an amazing job of painting a portrait of a person with, like, a very obvious PTSD and, like, mental issues in a way that does not feel like, let's all tweet about this now. Like, right. I don't know. It just... I think that show does such an effective job of being, like, this is a very... for better or worse word, you're like a very damaged person.
Right.
And it does not paint him similar to how this, it's not.
Yeah,
like
I actually think
hero.
It's a good, yeah, I think it's a good comparison because it neither, like with that sort of like PTSD thing, you could imagine the show that like, says that, deifies that kind of character in a way, you know, maybe right. not the version of him that's a hitman, but that's like, you know, this person went through this thing and like thus anything that they do in their life, even if they do bad things, they are absolved because of it. And then you can also obviously see the show that goes full villain and just completely dehumanizes and villainizes.
Right, he's
the
just
character.
a killing machine because he went there.
And Barry is a show that is able to like be like, okay, this person is a person and like in a crazy heightened world, but is neither evil nor good. And I actually think more and more with Fosse and with Sam Rockwell's performance, they're finding that balance in this show.
Completely agree.
I've been more and more on, I mean, I said this last week, but on the Sam Rockwell performance train in this, and maybe it's just a, you know, you watch the first 10 minutes of a Shakespeare play and you're like, I don't understand what they're saying. And then by the, you know, 30 minute
right,
mark,
by the end,
like,
you're like, oh, wow, this is the air. That is the glorious sun. This pearl that she gave me, I do feel it and see it. And though 'tis wonder that enwraps me thus, yet 'tis not madness. I get it.
Sorry, still the first 10 minutes. I don't know what you're saying, Marty. but you know what I mean? That thing of like, you just sort of, you have to like adjust to the like
totally,
performance
to, like,
or whatever.
To hearing the thing. Yeah,
I think maybe that's what it is with me and him. But I'm digging it a lot more. And Michelle Williams continues to be great. I like that they've continued on in this episode what I think they sort of started in the previous episode of, like, making her a little bit more not, like, highlighting that she's not necessarily always the best person
either. Right, that she's not the perfect person.
Like, that she's, like, sort of being a bad parent in this episode and comes across a little, you know, the way that she is sort of like forcing him to continue on with Chicago, and maybe that's not the best thing for his health. I like the way that she's playing the less angelic sides of Gwen.
Yeah, I do too, because you see, it's just it's the hard work that pays off, right? It's like you see the building blocks of that character
right
from moment one, so you aren't upset when you're like, wow, Gwen Verdon isn't perfect, because she's not supposed to be perfect. She's a character based on a real person. So it's like you're watching this really, you know, I keep on saying it's direction, it's acting, it's pacing, it's writing, it's all these things. You can't just point to one thing, but her performance truly is like terrific. But they've done a really great job of sort of parsing out what moments to highlight when, in like a way that's very satisfying, I think, and that's telling like a bigger picture story than just like, this is the linear version of Gwen Verdon and this is the linear version of Bob Fosse.
Right. I think you see that in the way that they cut through the life, and I think like the title cards, I liked the one, there were maybe a couple other title cards in this episode, but when it starts with like 17 months since Bob Fosse's last award. That does a really good job of, in a, like, it is functionally telling us where we are in his life, but it's also setting up what will be the payoff of the episode, essentially, of, like, the ticking heartbeat of this man's life is validation, whether it's attention on stage, awards, sexual validation, any of the, like, that he just... that's the engine, and he can only run for so long off of one kind of validation until he needs that next thing.
And I think, like, yes, jumping 17 months ahead is perfect, because you're like, I don't want to really see, if I only get 8 episodes of this show, which I'm a little bummed is all we get, but is, I don't want to see, like, the slow degradation of him getting to the point. Like, you could imagine an episode that would come between that last one and this one, but
yes,
they're very smart in the way they slice the meat and see, like, no, this is the prime cut is here, let's do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there, we could have told a good story there, but let's just get to the meat of the next big moment of his life.
Right. And in some cases, 17 months, I guess, is practical. Although, for the case of the casting of the, of what was her name?
I keep on calling Pickle.
Her Sally, and it's not Sally. Yeah, Pickle.
Nicole.
Nicole.
Yeah,
in the case of her casting, it's a little bit more like a five-year jump than a 17-month jump.
That was a little strange. I feel like they just sort of miscast. I mean, she did a good job, but, like, it also didn't totally track for me when she had to be, like, dressed up like she was an adult, because she already she didn't seem like, but that actor seemed like she was like 16 or something like that, and I think she's
supposed
to be, that
actor seemed older to me.
Yeah, like in a way where it was like, oh, you wouldn't really need to dress this person up to have them pass for 18. Like,
right,
they probably would, but I feel like the character's maybe supposed to still be like 14 or something there.
Yeah. Now, I did think that she did fantastic work.
Yes. No. I think
that's obviously like why they have her.
Yeah.
In there,
no. I think
version.
It was. I think it was a good performance, and that's just always a hard thing of like knowing the right.
That's just
notches
the
up of age wise, like where you're just like, well, we don't want to make it look like we just recast the daughter partway through it. If it is a, you're like, at what point, like somebody plays older, and then at what point do you have to bump up to the next person? And you're like, you know. This episode is interesting because we keep talking about, you know, the North Star of the show being all that jazz, and this was the episode that basically covered all of the events that inspired all that jazz,
yes,
right? Like, and we predicted that last week that this is what this would be. But
and
I think
it also is cut very similarly to it, like editing wise,
yes,
of those,
yeah,
sort of moments where he's talking to wow. I completely just blanked on her name, which is terrible.
Gwen,
like the angel
Gwen
of death,
Verdon?
Basically. No, like in all that jazz.
Oh
my
the
God.
Actor's
it's like
name?
Embarrassing. Yeah. It's
Leland
embarrassing.
Palmer?
I can't remember her name. No.
Anne Rankin?
No, I'll remember when we stop recording. So just right, put it in here. Beep.
You're editing this one. but I thought, you know, I think we both had like a little, not a concern, but like a question of how they would cover those events and not just do all that jazz. And I actually thought it was very cool how they like covered it in a way that felt like it owed a debt to all that jazz, but used a very different,
yes,
device of the you know,
the
him
the
living
comedy.
in the film within the film. Yeah.
Jessica Lange.
Now,
that's who
Jessica
I'm trying
Lange.
To say.
Oh, of course. Now I'm for some reason blanking on the name Lenny Bruce. That's how I keep.
Yeah,
I,
Lenny Bruce.
I was trying to say, you know, him doing the whatever thing. I couldn't remember Lenny Bruce.
And I will just like give a shout out to my own knowledge for a second, because I'm often like, wow, I don't know anything, and thank God I watched the show with Allie because she knows everything. But the actor playing Lenny Bruce, great casting, Brandon Uranowitz. Who I saw live in Falsettos, and he was terrific as Mendel.
Okay.
And I
and
was very
so
proud. Like, he like flashed on the screen.
And I was like, hey, it's
Brandon Uranowitz. And Allie was like, what? And I was like, look, pause. And she was like, oh my God, yeah.
Wow. So he's playing Dustin Hoffman playing Lenny
Bruce. Right,
playing
Lenny Bruce.
Very
talented actor, good performer.
Yeah. Good.
I've never seen Lenny, but
neither have I. I thought he did a good job of playing footage that wasn't quite working. Like that's what it was. I mean, and that's also all in the editing and stuff too. But it was like they did a very good job of it. It was like he was acting well, but there was like the footage felt wrong. Like it felt like it was just
right,
not coming together well, which is maybe more in the editing than anything. But it was fun.
That's how I feel about all my improv scenes. I'm always playing an improviser who's just not quite good enough at improv.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you get noted afterwards, and you just say, "Well, actually, I was playing an improviser improvising there." And so it was in the edit.
Yeah, it was in the edit.
I actually needed a sweep edit about five lines earlier, so I don't know.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, I was like, I kind of did like a little ringing with my hand above my. So it was like, let's sweep it, and people thought I was doing a lasso. Somebody came out and said, "Howdy, partner." No, I was a sweep. I was saying, "Let's sweep." I don't know, guys. I quit. And I'm not gonna pay for today's practice. I'm just don't Venmo me for this one. Anyone want to grab a beer?
I'll see you all. Yeah, anybody want to grab beer upstairs because we are downstairs at the Triple Crown?
Yeah, Marty, this isn't a practice. This is a show.
Oh boy.
What else in this episode? What do we want to hit?
So much happened. You know, it's a lot. It's a lot to talk about. He's in the hospital. I love the scene with
Should we say the plot? I don't think we said the plot of the episode.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about it. So the episode is he's back at rehearsal for, or he's at the first day Chicago. He's coughing up a storm. He's obviously unwell, very sick, and he's in the middle of editing Lenny while also beginning this process. So he's has no sleep. He's eating what looked like a delicious Hershey bar. Oh my God. I missed that wrapping so much.
That silver wrapping. Yeah.
Yeah. I bet the silver makes the chocolate taste terrible.
Hopefully. Otherwise I'm going to eat that whole bar, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah, and so then he feels chest pains, goes to the doctor. His primary care physician refers him to the hospital because he thinks there might be something going down, and it turns out there is. He has a heart attack, and it's sort of the back half or the back two-thirds of the episode are him recuperating from the heart attack and the Chicago production being pushed, and sort of there's some pressure to get a new director in. But Gwen Verdon wants to keep him. I guess that's before he's in the hospital, and then he like goes into surgery for the like open heart surgery, I guess is what's happening. And it's a, you know, sort of at the hospital episode. But while all this is happening, we're again getting these cuts to him not really doing a Lenny Bruce impression, but he's on stage doing what has the rhythm of stand-up comedy, but is just him. No punchlines, really, just saying very dark, extemporaneously, personal things.
Yeah.
And then these flashbacks to the childhood and his abuse by the older women at the vaudeville houses, and like his relationship with his dad.
And his mom.
Yeah. Which when I was about two-thirds of the way through the episode, I started to think, I like all of what's going on, but this is what I was thinking in the middle, and my opinion did change, but I was thinking, like, I don't get why we're flashing back to this in this episode. I get why all of this is important to his story, but it wasn't really clicking for me why this was the episode to do this. And I was like, I feel like there's already sort of a lot going on. Is this too much? But then I thought in that last little montage that puts it together, it did a very good job of connecting it all. Yeah.
Yeah, so like the, you know, for people who haven't who haven't seen it, what are you listening to this for? But yeah, that moment of him, you know, asking her, I need to feel like I need to know that I'm still a man. Just his very skewed, sexual nature and basically coercing her into
heavily suggesting,
yeah.
That she has sex with him on the hospital bed, and the relief that he gets from it, that is then through all of this editing, like associated with the applause and with his childhood abuse and with, you know, again that beating tap dancing rhythm.
Yeah.
And just the look on her face, which is very different than that, it crescendoed in a way that was like, damn, this whole episode's pre-framed in my mind of what it's about.
Yes.
Just like, yeah.
I think I will probably watch this one again, which I haven't for the rest of them, but I kind of want to go back and watch it again. I just, the imagery of him telling jokes that aren't jokes to a crowd of no one laughing is so powerful, and I just loved that. It felt like what a brilliant way to frame the way that we talk to ourselves. It's sort of like to this sort of hostile audience.
Right. Yeah, it's
passive audience.
I mean, I love that, like, the recurring thing with the show is the way that it dramatizes one's internal monologue, or like one's not I mean, in this case it was literally a monologue, but just like one's interior life. Not a lot of shows like visualize it in the way that this show does.
Yes.
And it's done it in a lot of different ways, and I love the way that they do it there, where it's just like that idea. And I think that's a thing of like a lot of like the, I mean, I think anyone who does comedy knows this, of just the way that you want to like put the darker feelings you have into the form of a joke, or into the form of saying something that's funny. But the way that this that sequence, or that continued world of the show, realm of the show,
realm is good.
There's a better word. I'm trying to think, like a dimension. Like it felt like it was cutting between like different dimensions or whatever. But where it just like unmasks like the fact that there's no laughter, and the fact that they're really not jokes at all, but they're said in the rhythm of jokes. I think that's like a very telling thing. I love that.
I guess like last lingering things, I loved the conversation that Gwen had with Nicole, of just like, aren't you, when Nicole was like, aren't you mad that she's always there? She's his girlfriend and you're his wife. And her, I just always appreciate when kids and parental relationships are like written well, and her just being like, no, it's too, we're different. You know, what we have is a different thing, and it will be. And just the fact that she was there when he woke up and he was, you know, holding hands while she's knitting. I just like those like tender moments, just like really just paint a picture of just such an interesting, complex relationship that I think they speak to in the show really well.
It really is a uniquely complex relationship between them. Like, I mean, it's just one you don't see explored that often on in media, which is just this like this intimacy that they have that extends well past their relationship. And you know, it's not necessarily the most healthy intimacy at all, but it is like, it feels like a certain kind of, what's the word for, like when two people like only function well together, and like that,
like codependent
codependency. It's like, it's like a certain kind of codependency, but one that you're like, at this point in each of their lives, I want them to continue having each other, because that's the world that they've built for themselves. It is.
Right. It's, and we've Bobby seen and the Gwen. Alternative. Like,
you sense that he needs her more than she needs him, which is a little, that's like a lot of, that's an onus to put on her that she shouldn't have to carry. But she does also seem at this point to be like, she does need him in a certain way too, or at least maybe she thinks she needs him. Like, people are telling her, you know, her new husband is telling her, you know, you could do Chicago without him and it would still be a hit, you're Gwen Verdon. And I think it's true, but she doesn't really believe that, I think. One other thing I wanted to point out, which was just a, you know, I've been highlighting some of my favorite small performances. I loved the performance of the doctor who wants his autograph.
That scene was great. Yeah.
I just thought that was a great scene. And that guy just, I don't know. It's just like,
just great casting.
It could be a much more simple performance, but he just, I don't know who the guy is, but he just like, he makes that character weirder and more specific than he needs to be. And I loved it.
Yeah, like, is that a thing? It is directing, but is it also just like, I guess when you're working on a thing that you know is going to be good, maybe you just are better. Like, I was in a show in college that, like, for all intents and purposes, was like a perfectly fine Shakespeare show. It was Measure for Measure, which is the weirdest show in the world. But, like, there was a live band and everybody just, like, really bought into the concept. And so our director was like, we're making something great. And, like, then everyone was better because of it. And I just, like, wonder, is it just, like, you know when you're a part of something special so you're good? Or is it also just, like, good direction and good filmmaking?
I think it's both, probably. I think the first thing's definitely a thing. And I think, like, you're an actor, you get cast in this role, you show up on set, and Michelle Williams walks out and starts giving her performance, you're like, oh, shit, she's here to play. I think, like, when you have people leading number one and number two on the call sheet, leading the cast like that, I think that a rising tide lifts all boats, like, when you see their level of commitment to it. But I also, I do think it must be directing or something about what the atmosphere on set was like. I think it's giving people... I don't know how many, like, days they shot these episodes in, but I feel like it was a longer production schedule than your average 8 episodes of television. Like, the sense that I get is that this was shot probably more, like, at the speed of a movie than a TV show. So, like, you know, they might have had a lot more hours to play with those scenes than they would on, like, a fast-paced network show or something like that. I could be wrong. They might just be using their time and using it well, but
I'm sort of just interested in that's all sort of a mystery, but I love it.
But it's absolutely true, you're seeing it, like, across the board in all of these little performances where that it feels like there must be some consistent thing happening to help those performances. It's not just great casting all around.
Yes.
And you could totally see that guy being on an episode of Grey's Anatomy or whatever, and it being him blending into the background, you know?
Yeah. Also, shout out to one of Allie's closest friends and a friend of mine, AJ Holmes, who played, oh, shit, I can't remember if he plays Kander or Ebb, but in that little mini scene, that's our friend AJ.
I forget if
he plays Fred.
Was he standing or sitting at the piano?
He was sitting with a weird gray wig.
So which is that? That's Kander, Ebb? I think. Oh, I was thinking Ebb was the lyricist, but I don't know.
Let's see. I could have just asked him, I guess, but he showed up and I was like, oh, hey. Let's see. Well, this is very interesting listening for anyone who's listening to me Google. You know what? Everyone, just look it up. Congratulations.
No. We gotta find that. You can find it. Just figure out which was the lyricist and which was the composer, and that's all you need to know. Because I assume the one sitting at the piano is the composer.
John Kander is an American composer, and Kander and Ebb. John, lyricist Fred Ebb.
Yeah. So he played Kander.
I could also just yell to Allie and literally ask.
All right, let's double check this.
Allie. Hold on.
Let's get her on mic, have her verified on mic. Marty is opening the door, going into the other room. I don't know if you guys could pick that all up on mic, but Allie did verify it was John Kander. Marty is sitting back down at the mic.
The results are in. It's John Kander.
All right. Very exciting stuff.
So I hope to see more of him. He's a great actor and dear friend.
Okay. So, hopefully there is more of him because he only got to really be in a montage there, kind of.
Yes.
Going forward, 2 more episodes. What are your thoughts? What are your hopes? What do you think we're going to see? I think I sort of said my pitch of the next 2 last week. I want to hear yours before we close it out.
I mean, I think that Khaleesi is going to get just absolutely drunk.
I think Gwen Verdon's going to become the Mad Queen.
Yeah, and I think that Bob Fosse is going to become the Mountain and the Hound.
It'll all be very earned by everything that they've written up to this point, and none of it will feel like a quick turn or like, they just want to make a Star Wars movie. The writing has been progressively getting worse
for 7 years. It will feel not like that.
No.
Yeah, the show will be very good and entertaining, and everyone will be satisfied. I guess what I really think is that I don't know where next episode is going, but I kind of get the sense that just how much this show plays with form and structure that feels reminiscent of All That Jazz, I kind of think that we're gonna have to see him making All That Jazz, and I think that might be where the show ends. I
could be wrong. So that would mean theoretically then next week is more like the full Doing Chicago episode,
and then the last episode is like All That Jazz and death.
Yeah, maybe you cut from like him on the death, or the Roy Scheider character like on the deathbed in All That Jazz, and then it is like a sharp cut forward and it says like 12 years later, and then it's like him on his actual deathbed, and you know, montagey whatever. I feel like that's right. I'm calling my shot. I mean based on you teed it up, but I think that's a good call of like it's All That Jazz into his death.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm wrong, I'm happy to be wrong, but I'll be interested to see how they.
I would like to see them introduce Roy Scheider, and we have a little bit of the making of All That Jazz, and then flashback 1974, Martha's Vineyard, the making of Jaws, and we just have a full episode on the making of Jaws. Wouldn't that be good? You get a young Steven Spielberg, you get a Richard Dreyfuss, you get a
Who would play young Steven Spielberg in this in the Broadway canon?
I want to throw my hat in the ring for it. I think I got the beard, I'm wearing a baseball cap right now.
And I am a young Richard Dreyfuss because I inspire students across the world with my opuses, with my opi.
Well, you know, Richard Dreyfuss could just play young Richard Dreyfuss like he did in Mr. Holland's Opus, where he, you know, wears makeup like he's 25 years old. if you got a young Richard Dreyfuss with your young Dustin Hoffman, you're really getting a lot of young people who would later be accused of many sexual harassment incidents.
Way to end the podcast.
Yeah, I just feel like once you like mention a Richard Dreyfuss, you can't just not acknowledge. Any final thoughts?
I look forward to the next episode. Any plugs? Yeah, sure. You can listen to my D&D podcast, Second Best D&D.
There we go.
We play Dungeons and Dragons. It's a bunch of UCB comedians having a fun... Well, I guess we're half UCB, whatever. We're a bunch of good comedians playing D&D together, and it's a lot of fun.
People are more than just make you their laugh. Theater identity. Who gives a shit if you're UCB comedians? You're good comedians.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you're UCB New York or UCB LA.
That's right. That's right. Okay.
What about you? What have you got?
Oh, I don't have anything. You know, if you see me on the streets of Hollywood, just give me a wink and a smile.
And smiled?
I did. I can't say the word wink without winking, I think. It's just a
physiological
reaction. Yeah, let's end this thing.
And then let's enjoy the episode coming out. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next week.
View you later.
View you later,
fellas.
To find more Smash Bros, go to smashbros.fun. That's SMASHBROS.FUN.
Or find us on iTunes, where you can rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast.
Smash Bros is produced in New York City by me, Marty Scanlon, and hosted by me and Jimmy Blackman.
I'm on Twitter at Jimmy Blackman, and Marty is at MC Scan.
If you know Brian Darcy James and think he would be down to do this podcast and maybe sing on it for us,
what the hell are you doing? Tell him to email us at podcastsmashbros@gmail.com. We'll see you next week on The Great White Way.
And now, Brian Darcy James.